Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to address this audience to tell you a little bit about what we are hoping to accomplish in this program on the physics of glasses. And I understand that I should sort of address the non-participants and to keep things at a generally comprehensible level. So I'll try to do that. I may end up probably oversimplifying things. I'll try to give an overview and an impression of the kind of problems that people working in the area of glasses worry about, and I'll give you an idea about what this particular workshop is about, okay. So just to start with the obvious point of reference, let me just say, for the sake of completeness, what glasses are. So there are three characteristics of glasses, which I'm going to. So these are substances which have some degrees of freedom, which are disordered, and as will probably become clear, these are systems which are frozen in some fashion, or arrested, or jammed, the various words that people use. And these are materials which are out of equilibrium. Okay, so this is a general characterization of what something that may be called a glass could be. And you know, the familiar example of what glass means to everybody is silica, which just to go through the checklist, has a structure that is not crystalline. So it's something that is characterized as continuous random network, tetrahedral random network, and the frozen in refers to the fact that this is an amorphous solid. It's not a fluid, but it's a solid. So it has rigidity, and it exists under conditions where the stable form of the material is quartz. Okay, so this is just to okay, for concreteness. And of course, oxide glasses are the most familiar, but one of many different materials that can exist in a glassy state. I won't sort of go through the list, but they're basically a wide range of natural circumstances in which matter exists in a glassy state. From the extremes of water in cometary tails to the cytosol in Arctic fishes and frogs, where the and under extreme conditions the cytosol basically becomes a richer sugar syrup and freezes into a glassy state in order to prevent cellular damage arising because of crystallization into ice. So Okay, so this is, and of course, there are also, in addition to oxide glasses, a wide range of materials that we make, which are glasses, from optical discs and, you know, plastics and what have you. A particular example that I want to mention, which I'll say a little bit more about, which is relevant for this workshop, is metallic glasses. Okay, so so these are all what are termed structural glasses, in the sense that the degrees of freedom which we are thinking about, which are characterized by these features of disorder, arrest, and are related to the positional about the positions of the atoms or molecules that make up these materials. But one can also think of other types of glasses. A popular well-known example is spin glasses, where you may well have a substance that has crystalline order in terms of the positions of the particles, but the degrees of freedom that are disordered are the orientations of the spins. Okay, similarly, in this broad definition of glasses includes granular material which is in a jammed state, and this is something that I'll say again a little bit more later on, and in soft matter, colloidal suspensions, foams, emulsions, etc., when they are in a structurally arrested state, are also examples of glassy systems. And okay, so that's as far as different kinds of substances are concerned. Concepts relevant to glassy physics also arise in contexts such as computational complexity, which I won't say more. Okay, now, so the next question is, of course, why is looking at these glassy systems interesting? And I don't know if quoting Phil Anderson in a mixed audience will have the desired effect, but to quote him anyway, he said back in 1995 that the deepest and most interesting unsolved problem in solid state theory is probably the theory of the nature of glass and the glass transition. And he went on to say that this could be the next major breakthrough in the coming decade. And on that, whether he's right about the first part or not, the breakthrough, by I think general consensus, hasn't yet happened 15 years after he made this statement. Anderson also, in the same remark, said whether it will, that is the breakthrough in understanding the glass state, will help us make better glass is questionable. So most of us sort of have been accepting this. I mean, people who work in sort of the physics end of the spectrum have been accepting this as sort of a largely true statement. But one of the purposes of the workshop that we're having here is in fact to ask whether understanding of the fundamental aspects of the glassy state will help us make better glass. And the particular glasses in question are metallic glasses. Okay. So in the broad context, there are a number of different aspects to this problem. And the first of them is something that is described as glass forming ability. And to explain this a little bit, most materials get into the glassy state when they are in the supercooled liquid. So if one looks at the free energy of a substance as a function of temperature, one has the free energy, the Gibbs free energy is what is intended to be plotted here. One has at high temperatures, the liquid as the most stable phase, And below the melting temperature, however, the crystal becomes the most stable thermodynamic phase because its free energy is lower. However, one can retain the material in the glass in the supercooled liquid state, a metastable state, and this cannot, however, I mean, it has to be, it can be done under certain circumstances, which I'll talk about a little bit more. However, this supercooling, even when one can maintain the material in a non-crystalline state, cannot go on forever. At some point, you have the glass transition. Okay? The question of glass forming ability therefore becomes a question of the ease with which a liquid can be cooled to temperatures below its melting temperature and be maintained in the liquid state. Okay, so this is sort of an issue that most of the time in the literature, the physics literature on glasses is glossed over. You usually read papers which start with a line that says, if crystallization can be avoided. And then they go on to talk about supercooled liquids, and that's the end of the mention of glass forming ability. Now, the second sort of general class of questions concerns the manner in which the relaxation times in the supercooled liquid and the viscosity and so on vary as a function of temperature or any other control parameter that one may be using. And this variation is dramatic, and I'll say more as I go on, and understanding why this variation is the way it is another class of questions. The third is the nature of the glass transition. And the fourth is the behavior of systems experimentally near the glass transition. And this sort of, well, there are different aspects to it, but aging is one of them. And fifth is the properties of the glasses themselves. So, and in particular, a question of interest is mechanical response of the glasses. And so, when we were discussing putting this program together, Michael Falk, who is one of the co-coordinators, so was making fun of people in my camp, saying, you know, you spend a lot of time worrying about how the glass forms, and then you lose all interest in what you make. And whereas there are people who are actually interested in how this material behaves. Okay. Okay. So just to go back at a broad conceptual level. So though I haven't probably said enough to explain the statement fully, if you know, going back to the question of why looking at the glass transition problem is interesting. So one way of sort of stating that is that, you know, we understand how to study materials which are in equilibrium from the prescription of equilibrium statistical mechanics, and we can sort of go a little bit beyond what equilibrium statistical mechanics allows us to do by looking at metastable states. So like I drew here, I have the liquid and the crystalline states, and these don't exist if I'm talking about equilibrium statistical mechanics only. But I say that, you know, I can sort of think in terms of extensions of these equilibrium states into a regime where it may not be the free energy minimum, and but still it's a local free energy minimum, and I can talk about these metastable states. Obviously, if one is trying to understand the behavior of a substance under different conditions and different histories, the fact that things can exist in a metastable state for finite periods of time will play a role in what is likely to happen if I were to do X, Y, Z to that material. The other kind of phenomenon which will take the system away from equilibrium behavior is if the substance were to get stuck in a glassy state. Okay. Now, I can ask the question, can I talk about getting stuck in a glassy state in the same way I would talk about a metastable state? And in terms of ideas people have about glasses, generally speaking, the answer may be yes, but there are two very important distinctions to make. One is that the metastable states that one may try to describe glassy behavior in terms of are not amenable to a very simple order parameter type description, like I had in the case of metastable states like liquids and crystals and gases. And the second difference is that if this is indeed the right way to think about glassy behavior in terms of many metastable states, among which the system may get stuck in, these metastable states, in addition to being hard to characterize, are numerous. They're exponentially large in number, and this we think is what leads to the complexity in the thermodynamics as well as the dynamics of glass forming liquids. Okay, this particular feature is something that does take us beyond concepts that we are used to from a variety of familiar systems in statistical mechanics, and therefore glassy behavior is a new kind of phenomenon that is of general interest not only for structural glasses but also for a lot of other materials. Okay. All right. So I'll try to go a little bit quicker about this. So I said that the viscosity and relaxation times, etc., of glass forming liquids varies very dramatically. And basically, if one looks at high temperatures, which is on the left hand side in this 1 over temperature axis, what one finds is behavior that could roughly be described in a simple-minded way as Arrhenius behavior. Okay, so there is an apparent activation energy that is given by the slope of this. But as you go to lower temperatures, there are strong deviations from Arrhenius behavior, which can be characterized as a temperature-dependent activation energy, which is becoming larger and larger as you go to low temperatures, and the range of variation of the viscosity in typical glass-forming liquids is over about 15 to 16 orders of magnitude. It's a very wide range, and this is going up to a temperature where you say, I no longer have the supercooled liquid. Whatever I have now, I'm going to call a glass. Okay, so this is so the glass transition is defined empirically as a temperature where relaxation times become about 100 seconds. Okay, so it's a kinetic effect which is defined by the experimental measurement that you have, and it's given by that scale. Now you can ask, okay, so if I look at different materials, obviously enough, different materials will have different PGs, and they'll have different behaviors. So a simple-minded question to ask is, if I take all of these different data, since I'm identifying this unique, if I'm by fiat, I'm saying there is this temperature called TG, how will this data look like if I were to scale my temperatures by this TG? Do I get unique behavior? Do I get data collapse? And the answer is no. What one gets is sort of a range of behaviors which are all pegged by definition to a fixed value of the viscosity at the glass transition, but the rate at which the viscosity changes, or the manner in which the viscosity changes, varies widely. And one of the questions that people would like to understand is why this is so. Why is it different for different materials? How can we understand why for a particular material the viscosity varies in a given way? And this behavior can be fit to
the denominator
reciprocal. Okay. So okay, so this behavior of the viscosity can be fit, among other forms, to something called the Fogel-Fulcher form, which contains in it a divergence temperature T0, which obviously is the experimental glass transition temperature, and therefore is never directly sampled, but this is a good fit for data of the viscosity. And this begs sort of the question of what's happening here. So if there is a singular temperature, what is the singularity? Okay, so that's one of the questions that I listed here, which is the nature of the glass transition. Is it a reflection of a singular transition of a dynamic or a thermodynamic kind, and how do we understand it? Okay, now so one of the reasons why people take this more seriously than other fit functions is the fact that, again, for a number of glass formers, if one looks at the entropy difference between the crystal and the liquid entropy being higher, by extrapolation, this entropy seems to vanish. This entropy difference seems to vanish at a finite temperature. Okay, and this is, you know, by itself not very meaningful because your experiment stops somewhere here. But what is interesting is that for a wide range of compiled data, the temperature at which this extrapolated entropy vanishes, entropy difference vanishes, which is called the Kaussmann temperature, is in fairly good agreement with this temperature where the viscosity, again by extrapolation, seems to diverge. Okay, so there has been speculation on whether these two temperatures are in fact the same temperature, and indeed if it is a singular temperature where some kind of a phase transition happens. I'm sorry? Yeah? You mean where is it?
Yeah, is there some special thing happening
once
it's melting? Sorry? The melting temperature.
Mm-hmm. Of the crystal.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So it's down here. I'm trying to think of a number to, so it's probably 2 to 3 orders of magnitude from the infinite temperature value. So okay, I'll actually maybe this is a good point in time. So there are many temperatures that are relevant to looking at glass forming liquids. So there is a temperature that people refer to as TA or T star, which is roughly about the melting temperature, where, well, this is not a very strong, very, very strictly true statement, but this is roughly the case. And this is where you begin to see deviations from Arrhenius behavior. Okay? So like I said, probably two to three orders of magnitude change in the relaxation times. And further down, you have something that I'll talk about shortly, which is called TC, which is about five orders of magnitude change in the relaxation times, where there is a prediction of a singularity which is not, in fact, observed. And then you have TG, which is, like I said, about 15 orders of magnitude. And then you have the other temperatures. Okay, that's just something to keep in mind.
Again, how you measure TG? I mean, is it by the 16 orders of magnitude, or?
Well, so basically, yeah. I mean, so if I'm using the viscosity, that's the definition. It's when this reaches a particular value of the viscosity. That's when.
And what's Celsius value? And what's Celsius value?
It's 10 to the 13th point. So,
but actually you can measure it thermally as well.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. But you also have, you can look at heat capacities. And what you find is that the heat capacity at some point drops. Okay, and this is again a drop that, I mean, it's a thermodynamic variable that you're measuring, but this drop is happening because you've frozen out degrees of freedom. Okay, and this is also a way of specifying where the glass transition temperature is. And of course, you know, this is a rate dependent temperature, because it depends on how fast you change the temperature. So experimentally, people use some standard ramp up and down temperatures, and so.
Sorry, where on this temperature scale is this possible singular temperature T0? Is it much further down than the glass temperature, or?
Okay, now this is, for liquids on this end, it's very close. Okay, for liquids on this end, it's not so close. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so now, right. Okay, so now, as I said, the dependence on measurement timescales is most evident in this case, for example, where the glass transition is. And of course, a lot of other properties as well display signs of sort of being dependent on your protocol, depending on how long you wait, etc., and near the glass transition. So in this range, so one of the things that does happen is that if you form a glass, let's say you're below the glass transition temperature, but not too far below, then if you make measurements on what you think are stationary properties of the material, you will find that these properties change over time. So one of the standard things that people look at is I don't know what the symbol is the deformation of a sample under a fixed strain stress. This is called a creep measurement. And basically these curves, this is on log temperature, but anyway, not important. What is important is that if you wait longer and longer, the time it takes for a certain degree of deformation to happen will become longer and longer. Okay, and if I were to assign a relaxation time for each of these measurements, what I find is that these relaxation times basically grow as the time for over which I wait. Okay, so this behavior is called aging, it's okay. So one of the other ways in which, so basically the physical idea of what is happening is simply that the system in fact is structurally evolving in time, even though it may not be obvious on short time scale measurements, and therefore over long periods of time it's the properties of a glass will change. And so well, the question is, how does one think about this? And one way of thinking about it is to think in terms of an internal temperature that the glass is in. So when I look at data like this, I can say that the system structurally is stuck at this glass transition temperature. Or even if I change the bath temperature to much lower values, structurally it is still here. Okay, so this is some internal temperature I can think of, and when I look at data of this kind, I can imagine that maybe perhaps the internal temperature is changing. Okay, I don't want to say too much about this, but one of the ways in which people have looked at this is by looking at the fluctuation dissipation ratio. So in equilibrium, the response of a system if I were to take a magnet, apply a magnetic field, and wait and look at the magnetization as a function of time, that's my response. And this is related in equilibrium to the temperature at which I am, and a correlation function of the magnetization in this example without the application of the external field. Okay, so now if I were to plot this response as a function of my correlation, so if I make a parametric plot, the slope of this gives me the temperature. And what is observed is that this slope in aging systems is not, for all values of the correlation function, the bath temperature. Okay, and this people have associated with an internal temperature, and the people who can talk a lot about this, which I won't do, but the idea is, you know, this is a context in which the notion of this effective temperature comes in, and in a wide range of contexts, what this temperature is, how to sort of understand it in microscopic terms is a very fundamentally important question. The broad question is to understand how to do thermodynamics with a system that is not in equilibrium. Okay. So there are a couple of contexts in which some of the people who are here have sort of worried about similar ideas of effective temperatures. One is in the context of soft glassy rheology, where basically the question you ask is if you're applying if you have something like an emulsion or a colloidal suspension, and you're applying some kind of stress, the system will respond. So let's say initially it's in a glassy state, so it has rigidity, but beyond a yield stress, it will yield. and then it's going to move, and you want to come up with an description of how this happens. The basic idea here is that associated with your sort of pumping in energy into the system is some kind of a temperature, which will act as the bath temperature does normally in making activated processes possible, which lead to the development of strain. Okay, and so this is one context in which this notion is used. Another context, which is something that is sort of has a family resemblance, is the context of looking at deformation of amorphous solids, but particularly, you know, of the kind that metallic glasses are. And so this is also a context in which there is the notion of an internal temperature, or the notion of a temperature which is other than the bath temperature comes in. And this is so the experts on both of these are in the audience, Peter Solich, Mike Gates, and Jim Langer, so, but in both cases, it's there is not at least a fully digested way of associating what these temperatures are in terms of the microscopic physics of the system. Yeah, and so this is sort of a broad area of interest. These examples I gave are phenomenological models, so one thing that I was going to mention later on, where one tries to sort of look at some quantity that is microscopic that may be a candidate in defining this temperature, is from computer simulations, where one looks at some characterization of the energy landscape that is sampled by the liquid. So,
I don't understand this. The graph you drew there plots chi versus C of TT.
Well, it's a parametric plot. So, I mean, basically, you have two times. You're keeping what the.
I'm trying to, or is it for a fixed T prime?
It's for fixed T. It's
for fixed T. Yeah. That. So it's for fixed T. You vary the T prime. Yeah.
Fix the laser.
No. That's not what this. That's why I'm confused.
Well, I didn't.
It's chi versus C for fixed T prime. For different.
No, so in order for this to work out, what you have to do is to vary the T prime.
Oh, I see. So you assume that there's. You fix T and you vary T prime then? I see.
Okay. Right. So, okay,
the temperature you infer is also a function of time. It's not straight, right?
Right.
So
there's a certain amount of response that you have in a system which is directly related to the bath temperature always, right? Which does not require a structural relaxation. Okay, so if I take a viscous fluid and if I apply stress, there is sort of a short time response which doesn't need the structure to change in any way except compressively, for example. But there is a longer time process which will need the structure to relax, and that's what is reflected in the part of the curve with the other slope. Okay. Right. So I think sort of going a bit slow, what is the, should I? Okay. All right. So I mentioned that one of the sort of the goals of our workshop was to try and make a link between the work in the sort of the physics chemistry community looking at supercooled liquids, which are glass formers, and work which looks at the making and behavior of metallic glasses. And so I just want to say a little bit about what are broadly the sort of interface areas in principle, and why metallic glasses are interesting. Basically, these are amorphous solids made up of many different components. So they're multi-component alloys, and these components are sort of chosen with some rules of thumb, such as a size mismatch that is bigger than 15%, and a negative enthalpy of mixing, and more than a certain number of components, which are basically sort of good heuristics for ensuring that the alloy that you make will have different atoms that mix well, and which will frustrate the crystallization of any one of these components or some combinations thereof. So this is sort of a lot of people are involved in basically with some guidance from these kind of thumb rules making metallic glasses by trial and error. And if there is a better understanding of what glass forming ability means, this could make the process of making better metallic glasses more rational. So this is sort of one area where there is possibly an interface between a conceptual understanding and practical applications. The other is basically looking at the response of these metallic glasses. They have in the context of mechanical behavior, these are materials which have very high strength, but they also show catastrophic failure. So so they're very good at sort of not losing any mechanical energy you put in up to a point, but then when they fail, they fail completely. So they don't have what you normally see in crystalline metals, which is ductile behavior. Why they respond in the way they do to applied stress is something that, as I already mentioned, is a problem which calls for a fundamental understanding of glassy materials, but it's also an area which is of very practical interest. Okay. I just want to sort of very briefly summarize some of the theoretical approaches people have been using in trying to understand slow relaxation and in supercooled liquids above the glass transition temperature, and probably stop there. So at some level, the obvious way of trying to approach this problem is to look at time-dependent behavior in a liquid that is near equilibrium, one then tries to solve for time correlation functions based on input that is given by this, the static structure and properties of the liquid. And this is something that is attempted by mode coupling theory, which is basically tries to solve for the density correlation functions based on an ansatz that's plugged into a generally valid generalized Langevin equation. Okay, and this, as I said, has various predictions that are partially verified in terms of apparent power law, in terms of power law behavior of relaxation times, for example, diverging at a critical temperature TC, but these are predictions that are found to be valid in a finite range of temperatures. The understanding is that they fail when they do because they do not take into account processes that are activated in nature. Now, these activated processes are in turn is the focus of, generally speaking, energy landscape approaches, and in this one has, among other things, spin glass based theories of the glass transition. So here I'm sort of compressing things a bit too much, but basically the idea is that you do have, as I mentioned already in the beginning, the development of metastable states that come into existence at low temperatures in a mean field description of the system that you may be looking at. And these are statements that arise from looking at spin glass models in the mean field approximation. But the question is how those ideas translate when you look at systems with finite range interactions, which is what supercooled liquids are. And the picture that people have is that these metastable states that are separated by infinite barriers translate to some approximations with finite energy barriers when you look at systems with finite range interactions. And at this level, one can also think in terms of an energy landscape, which is something that has been a productive exercise through computer simulations, which give you access to looking at detailed information about the potential energy landscape of liquids. And in the sort of clean picture, you have sort of two regimes separated by the mode coupling temperature TC, above which the dynamics is a diffusive nature, which is described by the mode coupling equations, and below is you have a regime where the dynamics is activated, and in the mean field limit you have the prediction of a thermodynamic phase transition. And in practice, this separation is not so very clean, in that what one sees is a wide range of temperatures where behavior seems to be both partially consistent with mode coupling theory and with an activated picture of the dynamics. So this is an ongoing story which many people are working on. One of the recent questions in this context, which is sort of again a very general and simple-minded question to ask, for which we don't have a clear answer, is are there length scales that are relevant in a glass-forming liquid to the growing time scales in the problem. So a simple-minded candidate is some kind of a length scale that is structural in nature. The conventional view on this has been that in a supercooled liquid, there isn't any change in structural order. Okay. So instead, a popular candidate in the recent times for a length scale has been what's called a heterogeneity length scale. The basic idea is that as you go to lower and lower temperatures, what you begin to see is if I look at the system in some region and find that the particles are mobile in that region, if I look for other particles that are mobile, they are found to be spatially correlated. So there is a correlation in the mobility of particles across space, and this allows me to define a correlation length. And this correlation length has been studied quite a bit. Interestingly, the length scales that people have looked at by other means have all turned out to be fairly modest. They're very small lengths, like 4 and 6 particle diameters. And this sort of begs the question of whether we should not look at structural ordering more carefully, because it's even though people have sort of held the view that there is no structural ordering that's happening that is dramatic, it appears that whatever changes in length scales that one has obtained by other means are not dramatic and therefore may well have a structural basis. And this is again an issue that connects to people looking at metallic glasses who are trying to understand the kind of structural order that is short-range structural order that is present in these systems. Okay, I think that's a good point to stop. I apologize, it got a bit sped up in the end. Thank you.
Some questions? First, from people not in the program? Any? Why is it theoretically that T phase corresponds to T zero?
Well, we don't have a very good answer to this question, but TK is a temperature where an entropy that we define that corresponds to distinct configurations that the liquid can be in goes to zero. And there are ideas attempt to link this a configurational entropy, as it is called, to relaxation times, specifically in the form of a relationship that says relaxation times are exponentially dependent on the configuration entropy in this way. If this is true, and if this is true, then it's obvious why the two are related. But though there is a lot of support for both ideas, they're not very well established.
You said the disorder is very important for glass formation. I was wondering whether you could have this kind of phenomenology. It seems to me there's no fundamental reason why it wouldn't happen in this system, which is disorder. I mean, where does disorder come in this whole
Okay, no, so...
Thank you.
No, so as I said that one of the key features of a glossy system seems to be the ability of the system to be in a large number of distinct sort of at least loosely connected parts of phase space. Okay, so it's hard to see how that would arise in the case of a system which has some long range order.
By disorder, you mean something that's a quench disorder?
No. So then this is also the quench disorder is the case that's in fact looked at for the most part in the context of spin glasses. But in the case of a supercooled liquid, the order is self-generated. The disorder is self-generated. I mean, it's not quenched.
If simulations reproduce the data somehow,
right?
What goes into the simulations? I mean, what principles or what assumptions are made?
So in simulations, typically, you know, the two classes. One is people sort of look at some simple-minded models system. So one popular choice is a binary mixture of particles that interact via the Lennard-Jones potential. And so the potential is what goes in, and then you do the dynamics that's governed by the microscopic dynamics, the Hamiltonian dynamics of the system, and this allows you to generate the trajectories with which you can look at both dynamics and thermodynamics. So one can go from there and try to be more realistic and model particular systems, but as a matter of principle, there's no difference. But yeah, so classical dynamics.
Is that what you would say is microscopic?
Right. Yeah. So I mean, the idea is, you know, for the kind of phenomena you're looking at here, certainly you don't need a quantum mechanical treatment. You treat the atoms and molecules as classical objects, and you so the microscopic refers to the fact that you're looking at the full phase space trajectories of the system.
Questions?
Why is it obvious that you don't need quantum mechanics?
Sorry?
Why is it obvious that you don't need quantum mechanical treatment?
Well, because these particles, I mean, except for the light atoms, the de Broglie wavelength is smaller than the size of the particles. So that's, What's that question? It's
once you get to the regime of classical physics,
right?
This is what usually want to say. This is more something that's not a direction as opposed to detail, you know,
structure, right?
Mechanics, which is hard.
Yeah, so there are different ways that people slice this. And if you say that thermal effects being important is what characterizes soft condensed matter, then definitely this is soft condensed matter. But,
granular mature.
Sorry?
You already mentioned granular mature.
Right. So, there is some temperature whose effects are important. So, I guess you know it's that's yeah. So Peter, did you?
I'll ask you later.
Okay. Well, thank you.